Good morning, everybody. It's time for a little MLB strategy show. Now, typically on Saturday mornings, Ab and I are doing the NBA strategy show. But that's not an option today because there are no NBA games. Day off in the NBA schedule, then tomorrow is the last two-game NBA slate of the entire season, I assume anyway, because I'm pretty sure that's how the schedule is going to work. I don't think there's going to be Eastern and Western Conference Finals games on the same night. So you guys are going to want to check all that stuff out tomorrow. But also, in the meantime, we've got baseball, and we're going to have to be talking a lot about baseball over the upcoming months. Like this video, subscribe to the YouTube channel so you know when there's more baseball stuff coming out. Adam, how are you doing this weekend?
Doing pretty well. Excited to talk about something other than basketball. So still feel a little rusty when I talk baseball since I do it like once every 3 weeks at this point. But yeah, just excited for a change of pace. I'm tired of talking about the same two teams every other day.
And it's not like you're way out of the baseball streets, because we have to go back, what, 5 days since you won a six-figure win in baseball?
Yeah. Been playing. It's just, you know, talking about it's different, because like when I'm playing, I'm just making lineups. And then when you're talking, you're trying to like contextualize things. And it's just like, oh, this is stuff that I haven't actually really looked at because I haven't had to talk about it.
And by the way, also, we're going to be talking about the main slate here. I know that there is a three-game earlier slate. If you guys have questions about that, we can hit on those at the end. If you don't, that's fine. I'm not going to make you guys ask questions, but we could hit on that after this, after we get through the main slate. And today's show is sponsored by Prize Picks. If you guys have not signed up for Prize Picks, you could do it using the promo code Osmo. Get up to a $100 bonus on your first deposit, and you also get yourself one free month of Osmo Plus Platinum. Get access to all the tools that you need to build winning MLB lineups. So maybe you're somebody who's coming from playing NBA. You want to get into MLB because the NBA season is winding down. This is a good way to get your foot in the door and get access to some of those tools. But let's start by talking about tonight's nine-game slate, beginning with the Houston Astros against the Washington Nationals. Christian Javier is going to be on the mound for Houston, and he's off to a really, really strong start this year. And it doesn't even seem like Houston really wants to use him in the starting rotation. They try to push him to the bullpen when they can. When we see him in the starting rotation, he's done nothing but dominate. 30.9% K rate, 2.97 expected ERA. Adam, how do you like his prospects tonight against a not-so-great Washington Nationals offense beyond Juan Soto?
Yeah, pretty weak Nationals lineup. The way I view it is kind of, you know, obviously you have to get around Soto. You have to navigate Josh Bell and Nelson Cruz, and then you're basically home free. This is not a very deep lineup at all. Only a 3.8 implied run total here. And like you said, Javier has been very good from a strikeout standpoint. The salary is up to $9,400, making him the third most expensive pitcher on DraftKings. That's a concern, just given that he hasn't thrown more than 87 pitches in a game this year. Because like you said, I think ideally would not be using him in this role. So that's the biggest concern I have, is just that, you know, he is pretty expensive, and I find it unlikely that he's giving you, you know, 100 pitches or anything like that. But still makes him look good. Also, as a starter, I guess definitely worth noting, the strikeout percentage is only 20% in the games that he has started. But like you said, overall, very good strikeout numbers this year.
And then one other thing that I'll add about Christian Javier, well, actually, it's going to be two things. He's only projected for 1% ownership right now on DraftKings, and the pitching options aren't that great today. Like, a lot of these guys I have concerns about. Like, I guess I have to buy into Chris Bassett at this point in time because he's been so good over the last year and a half. But I have question marks with Shane Bieber. What's that?
I forgot how much you hate Chris Bassett.
I mean, I don't hate him. It's just to me, I look at it, it's like really $10,300 for Chris Bassett. Like, the numbers bear it out at this point in time. But I don't look at Bassett as 10,300 pitcher and be like, oh, cool, I want to have this guy in like 50% of my lineups. And I need to roster some other starting pitchers. I have big concerns with Shane Bieber. Zach Gallen also is really good, but I don't want to load up on a 9,800 Zach Gallen either. And I just view Christian Javier as a pretty easy pivot to get to, and he's only projected for 1% ownership.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, the I guess red flags I brought up, you know, the pitch count and the fact that the strikeout rate is down as a starter, those are kind of mitigated by what you were saying. You don't have those top tier pitchers today. So this is a slate where, you know, typically you see dynamic pricing with pitching, where pitchers that would normally be, you know, $7,500, $8,000, they're more expensive when there's not good pitching on the slate. And, you know, so you have Chris Bassett and Zach Gallen as the only two pitchers more expensive than Javier, and they both have their own, I don't think concerns is the right word, but I mean, it's not like it's a great matchup for Bassett. Gallen is good, but like you said, probably not a nearly 10K pitcher on a normal slate. So just getting to Javier and kind of hoping it breaks into one of those slates where it's not that you think Javier is going to go get 30, but you're more hoping like Javier gets 20, 21, and those other guys get like 15, 16.
Yeah, and then on the other side of the game, Eric Fetty is going to be pitching for Washington, and he's been slightly better this year than we've seen in the past, 19.8% K rate, expected ERA in the mid-fours, but he's going up against this Houston Astros offense that's just a juggernaut. And the other thing that's key right now is they also got most of their guys healthy. They were missing Yordan Alvarez at points in time this year. He is now healthy, and it's also not a team that's picking up that much ownership. Like, when I'm just looking at this game at first glance and I'm like, okay, the Astros coming off a really big game against Eric Fetty, sure, they're going to be really popular. They have one of the highest implied team totals on the slate. But then I look and I see they're only projected for 8% ownership over on DraftKings. And this is a team I'm going to have to prioritize pretty highly as a stack.
Yeah, it's the nice thing about Coors Field slates when there's a decent number of games is you're just naturally going to get ownership going to Coors Field. And so it makes a lot of these other good spots look really good. And to be fair, Eric Fetty has been solid this year. He has a 4.2x FIP, so that's actually up from where it had been. 0.9 home runs per nine innings, 19.8% strikeout percentage. So coming back to earth a little bit, but he did start out the year well. But it is a very difficult matchup, like you said, going up against Houston. The lineup's getting healthier. You have Altuve back. You know, Alvarez is in there. So I think it's a good spot for Houston. They are still pulling some ownership, but not as much as, you know, the teams in Coors are.
Yeah, and that's also, we're going to talk about Coors later, but more often than not, shitty pitchers at Coors Field, we end up getting really, really highly owned offense there, which is the case today. Moving on to the next game, Boston Red Sox, Texas Rangers, and these are two pitchers it's going to be really hard for me to find any interest in. First, Glenn Otto, he just has not produced results at the big league level. He has a 6.36 ERA this year. And then on the other side of Rich Hill, he's been okay this season, but we just don't see him work very deep into games, which probably isn't surprising when you consider that Rich Hill is now, what is Rich Hill at this point? 40?
Is he older than Tom Brady?
No, because Tom Brady is 44, right?
44 or 45. Hill, like, you could tell me Hill was 48, and I would be like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, Brady's 44. Rich Hill is 42. But the other thing with Rich Hill is, so he's still somewhat effective at this point in his career. He's a 2.86 ERA, 3.84 expected ERA. But here's the main way that he's been able to be, you know, viable at big league. He's not working deep into games. We're getting 4 to 5 innings out of him, 5 at a max in all of his starts. So 5 innings is the most he's pitched. And that's generally what we're getting out of him. And that's just not really enough innings for me to see a reliable upside. And that in the Texas Rangers offense is improved this year. He's pitching on the road. So I can't really have too much interest in either of the pitchers here. Do you feel any differently?
Maybe a little bit more, but mostly on the same page. I mean, Rich Hill at 6,800. If you need the savings, you know, sure. Like, he's projected to be under owned, but still only has like an 8% chance of being a top two pitcher on DraftKings, 1% ownership. So it's somebody that I don't anticipate getting to much of, but like in a lineup out of 150, you know, here and there is fine. Glenn Otto at 7,300, I'm kind of interested in because he has shown the ability to strike guys out at the major league level. He walks too many guys. He's not a finished product by any means. So far this year, a 21.1% strikeout percentage, 10.5% walk percentage, xFIPs at 405, which is respectable. And the Red Sox offense has been absolute garbage. I don't think that they continue to be one of the worst offenses in baseball. So far, they only have an 83 WRC plus, but this isn't the same Red Sox lineup that, you know, you've seen in previous years. It's not as deep as normal. And so I think at 7,300 on a slate where pitching is pretty weak, like you said, I do have some interest in Otto. And right now we do have him projected to be a little bit underowned with a 13% chance of being a top two pitcher at about 12% ownership.
Yeah. And he is certainly low-owned, and the Red Sox offense has been much worse than expected this year. The team as a whole, the Red Sox are now something like 10 games under 500, and, you know, we're a fifth of the way through the season at this point. So Red Sox have definitely disappointed to some extent. And when I look at the offenses in this game, we've got Boston. They have a 4.5% chance of being a top stack. They are really low-owned. The Texas Rangers on the other side, they have one of the lower top stack odds on the slate at 3.4%. Is there anything you really like about either of these offenses?
Not really. Neither pitcher is picking up much ownership. Otto getting more than Hill. So if you were going to go that route, you would lean Red Sox. But it just kind of strikes me as a game where I'm not really in love with either side. Boston's projected to go a little bit under owned. So I guess I don't mind getting to them in tournaments, but still only a 4.5% chance of being the top stack. There's plenty of teams that I would get to before I get to them. And then it seems like a pretty rough spot for Texas just because Hill is still a good pitcher that you're solid enough pitcher that you're going to get for 4 to 5 innings. And then you're going to get, you know, bullpen arms matching up after that. So I think it's a pretty difficult game to want to target a lot of the offenses.
Yeah, overall, I think it's one of the least appealing games on slate, both from a pitcher perspective and from a hitter perspective. Not that the sides are unplayable, but there's nothing I'm going to be prioritizing either in this spot. Moving on to the next game on the slate, the New York Yankees against the Chicago White Sox. And we've got Jordan Montgomery on the mound for the Yankees, Dallas Keuchel for the White Sox. One thing that stands out to me about Montgomery this year is he is so vastly different than what we've seen from him in the past in terms of he's having better real-life results. But he's always been a really high variance DFS pitcher because he's sometimes struggled with run allowance. He's been a homer prone pitcher at times, but he's also always been a high strikeout guy. That's not been the case this year. It seems like he's maybe prioritizing his command more because his walk rate is down to 4%, but his strikeout rate is also down to 20.2%. For reference, last year was 24.5, the year before 24.4, the year before that 26.3. So I know the pitching options aren't great on this slate, but Montgomery individually doesn't inspire a whole lot of upside. Is he a pitcher you think you're going to want to be getting to in tournaments today?
Yeah, and I mean, so it is an interesting change, like you said. His strikeout percentage is about 3 points lower than his career average. His walk rate is like 3.5 points lower than his career average. So at least to this point, he's been a somewhat has been a different pitcher. And it's not like he has the easiest matchup going up against Chicago, but I think it is a reasonable price tag at 8,400. Especially just given the lack of other options on this slate. So he's another one where, like, I don't love getting to him, but he's projected for an 11% chance of being a top two pitcher, about 9% ownership. So basically, the pitching on this slate, ownership-wise, is kind of breaking down similarly to the offenses, where we talked about Coors Field pulling a ton of ownership. When you look at the pitcher ownership, you have Chris Bassitt, Zach Gallen, Shane Bieber pulling, like, all of it. So most other pitchers, you're going to be able to make the case, like, okay, I don't love this guy, but I can also offset a lot of ownership by just getting to him and hoping for the best. That's kind of how I feel about Montgomery, because I do still think that he's a talented pitcher. And we are, you know, what, 5-6 starts into the season. Stuff certainly can, yeah, 6 starts for Montgomery, 31 innings pitched. You can certainly just see his numbers move back towards what they have been in the past as well. So I don't mind getting to him in tournaments, but I'm with you as far as his new style of pitching, it seems, doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in DFS.
And then on the other side of the game, when it comes to Chicago White Sox, at least their offense against Montgomery, they only have a 3.8 implied run total. We do have a bunch of offense in the slate that are in pretty good spots. We have the Coors Field game. We've got the Astros. We've got the Yankees. We're going to talk about their offense in a little bit. So it's going to be hard for me to prioritize the White Sox because, like I just said with Montgomery, his pitching profile has changed this year. He's been more successful overall as a pitcher. And the home run to fly ball rate is down, which it's been trending down over the last few years. He used to be really homer prone. So in 2019, he had a 20% home run to fly ball rate. Then in 2019 was 20%. 2020 went to 16.7. Last year, 11.8. This year, 6.7. This also comes with an increased ground ball rate. So I don't really think stacking against Montgomery is the best course of action, just because I do think he's one of the more solid starting pitchers on the slate. Do you have interest in the White Sox offense?
That's how I see it as well. You know, like I always have some interest in the White Sox just because they have power in their lineup, but they don't look like a team that I expect to get a lot of here. One other thing I do want to mention on Montgomery, I just looked it up while we were talking. His plate discipline numbers this year are actually excellent, like better than normal. So that's just another thing that kind of makes that strikeout number seem weird to me. You know, strikeout rate does stabilize quickly, but we are still talking about 31 innings. So far this season, Montgomery's called strike plus swinging strike percentage is 3 points higher than his career average. His swinging strike percentage is 1.5 higher than his career average. His chase percentage on pitches out of the zone is like 3 points higher, 3.5 points higher than his career average. Like, everything across the board suggests that he should still be striking dudes out.
Yeah, that's good information. That's actually probably going to encourage me to want to, when I actually build lineups for the slate, get more Montgomery than I just thought I was when I first glanced at it. So I do think that is that's all really good and useful information. That strikeout rate for Montgomery probably going to regress back to the mean sooner rather than later. You know whose strikeout rate is not going anywhere most likely? Dallas Keuchel, because he sucks. And he's been bad for a really long time now. And he's kind of getting into... I don't want to say that he's in like Matt Harvey territory, but he's certainly in a territory where I'm confused why Dallas Keuchel is still pitching at the big league level, because he's gotten hit hard a number of years in a row. He doesn't generate any strikeouts. So he's a 4.45 expected ERA this year, 2.1 whip. Once again, the 12.4% K rate, his velocity is well below 90 miles per hour at this point in his career. How do we not like the Yankees in this spot going up against a soft throwing left-handed pitcher that generates a lot of contact? Because one thing that could be an issue with some of the top Yankees hitters at times is swing and misses, and Dallas Keuchel is not that guy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, like, Keuchel's good at getting ground balls, and that's the extent of things that Dallas Keuchel's good at this point. He walks too many guys. He doesn't strike anybody out. He doesn't miss bats. He doesn't limit home runs because he doesn't have the same command or stuff that he used to have. So it's really just when you're stacking against Keuchel, sometimes you're going to run into that really frustrating start where you're watching a guy that you're pretty sure you could get a hit off of, and your stack is just pounding the ball into the ground. But at this point in his career, more often than not, he's going to just be putting guys on base and then giving up home runs, giving up doubles. And like you were saying, I love a team like the Yankees against somebody like Keuchel because they have so much power. When they put the ball in play, it goes far. It's just a matter of having a lot of swing and miss in their lineup. And when you're going to cut down on the strikeout rates of guys like Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton and all of these guys and ask them to put the ball in play, it creates a really, really high upside spot in DFS. And this is a team that, you know, again, if this Coors game were like on the early slate or just didn't exist, the Yankees would be far and away one of the highest owned stacks here. But instead, they're getting about 9% aggregate ownership, which isn't nothing. I mean, there's a lot of teams on this slate getting 2-3%, but you compare that to, you know, Colorado at 16%, Kansas City at 18%. It's just naturally not contrarian in the sense that like nobody's going to be there, but just relatively low owned because of how much ownership is likely to go to Coors.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what we're going to see about most offenses on this slate is if the numbers as of right now, in terms of ownership and top stack percentages all hold, I'm going to be underweight to both the teams at Coors Field, which means by default, I'm overweight to pretty much any other offense, or at least around the field with any other offense that has a pulse today. And the Yankees are certainly one of them against Dallas Keuchel. So pretty high priority stack for me on this slate. Moving on to the next game, and I'm really curious to get your takes on Shane Bieber because he hasn't been awful this year, but this is not the same pitcher he's been in the past. He's taking on the Minnesota Twins. The Twins have a really solid offense. Bieber's also been priced down at this point. So he is $8,800 over on DraftKings. He's $9,100 on FanDuel. Now, here are the numbers for Bieber this year. 4.13 ERA, 4.42 expected ERA. Not good, but not totally awful either. But here's where the red flags kick in when it comes to Shane Bieber for me. Strikeout rate, 21.5%, way lower than we've seen in the past. And the velocity numbers. We know last year Bieber missed the majority of the season with a shoulder injury. He came back to make a couple of starts at the end of the year. I'm not really sure why they did that. But that aside, we could see the dip in velocity here. We're in 2020 when he was the best pitcher in baseball and he won Cy Young. He had a 94.3 average fastball velocity. Last year, he dealt with shoulder issues, 92.9 average fastball velocity. This year, 91.3. I don't know if he's still dealing with an injury, but these are red flags to me. How do you view Bieber first for today, the velocity, but then also, you know, a tough matchup against the Twins?
And to add to that too, at least according to the blurb on DraftKings, so whatever radar gun they were using, he didn't touch 91 miles an hour on a single fastball in his last start against the Blue Jays. He didn't strike out a single hitter. So like when you look at his strikeout stuff, like if you wanted to make the bull case for Bieber, it would be that strikeout percentage overall is impacted by the fact he didn't strike out anybody against Toronto. In his first couple starts of the year, he had 4-5. His three middle starts, he had 7-6-7. So, you know, started to look like he was coming around. But it's not going to make you feel good that the zero strikeout start where he had no velocity at all was also his most recent start when you're talking about somebody that's coming back from an injury. And then also his plate discipline numbers this year are down. So like we had talked about with Montgomery, where at least he's getting swing, at least Montgomery is getting swings and misses. He's getting chases on pitches out of the zone. Shane Bieber this year has a 26.1% called strike plus swinging strike percentage. His career average is 32.3%. His swinging strike percentage is 12.7% this year, 14.2% career. So you're not seeing the same sort of success there in, you know, getting swings and misses, getting hitters to take pitches in the strike zone, which, you know, is also a good result. So I do think all that stuff's concerning. It's also not the best matchup against Minnesota, like you said. And there is ownership coming in because the pitching on this slate is pretty weak. And because projections are going to give Shane Bieber a lot of credit for things he's done in the past, even though he very well may not be 100% right now, or, you know, just may not be like he at this point is not what he has been in the past. He still hasn't been bad, like you said, you know, like a 3.6 xFIP, but this isn't the same Shane Bieber we've seen in the past, stuff wise, velocity wise. The price accounts for that. You know, in the past, he'd be like $10,500. But the fact that he's popular does, you know, concern me a bit as well. We have him with a 22% chance of being a top two pitcher, 30% projected ownership. I'm not saying not to play Shane Bieber because, you know, he is 8,800. He is still Shane Bieber. But I do think there are very legitimate concerns here.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to have Bieber in my player pool. I'm probably going to be underweight to him, and I'll make some leverage stacks to the Minnesota Twins. I know they are pulling some ownership at 3%. It's not like we're getting them at 1 or 0.5%, which pretty frequently happens against big name pitchers that are going to be popular. But still, at the same merit, I think there is some leverage in rostering the Minnesota Twins offense against a popular Shane Bieber. And I just don't know where Bieber's at at this point in his career. If you tell me his velocity picks up and he's really good going forward, that wouldn't surprise me. If you tell me this is just who he is now as a result of injuries, that wouldn't surprise me either. So I'll be making some leverage stacks of the Twins. Is that a path that you're going to be going down?
I like it. Yeah. And shoulder injuries are tough too, because that's what it was, right? It was a shoulder.
Yeah. Shoulder injury.
Yeah. Cause like when guys come back from Tommy John, it's like, okay, cool. Like they have that perfected now and guys are going to be fine. Shoulder injuries can really be a problem for pitchers. So that's something else to keep in mind there. And yeah, it's a spot where, you know, obviously I haven't built lineups at 11:20 in the morning. So I don't know how much Minnesota I'll get to, but I do at the very least like the idea of getting there because they have power in their lineup. Their ownership projection is in line with their top stack percentage, both around 3.5%. But then you get that added benefit of the 30% owned Bieber, where if Minnesota does well, not only do you have an offense doing well, but 30% of the field just lost, you know, right off the bat. So that's, you know, just a really powerful way to approach baseball. It can be difficult to sort of balance rostering against popular pitchers and not just having your entire night revolve around stacking against the best pitchers on the slate. But this is a spot where I do think there's enough volatility and variance here that I am definitely interested.
And then speaking of pitchers, I don't know what to make of Devin Smeltzer is going to be starting for the Twins. This is his first start of the season. His recent minor league outings was last minor league outing. He pitched 2 innings. And in those 2 innings, he allowed 6 earned runs, struck out 2 hitters. Overall this year, he's made a handful of minor league starts, 4 innings, 5 innings, 5 innings. And then, like I said, 2 innings in the last one. I just don't know what to make of Smeltzer from standpoint of he's an unheralded young pitching pro, and he's not even that young. He's 26 years old. He's pitched so little in the minor leagues that I think we have to write him off for this slate when he only went 2 innings in his last start. So on the other side, then the Cleveland Guardians offense, I think they've overperformed a little bit this year. It's not a team that I thought was going to be especially good. But what do you make of Devin Smeltzer? And I don't think that we've seen an official starting pitcher named for the Twins, but MLB.com had Smeltzer listed as the likely starter.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's 4K, but I kind of just doubt that you need to get there. He's not a good strikeout guy. And like you said, we have a very limited sample for him. But in the major leagues, he's made a total of 7 starts. He's pitched 19 total games going back to 2019. He's struck out 19.2% of hitters. 4.94 xFIP. And while I agree with you, I do think that the Guardians offensive numbers eventually come back down. So far, they have the third best WRC plus in baseball, which when you look at the names in this lineup is insane. They are also difficult to strike out though, especially because you have Steven Kwan and Jose Ramirez in the same lineup. They only have a 19.6% strikeout percentage. So they've been a pretty difficult team to target in that regard as well. I doubt that I mess around with Smeltzer too much, even though he is only 4K.
Something else to point out about Smeltzer, because I just checked his velocity numbers. His average fastball velocity in the time he's been in the big league. So last year only pitched 4 innings, but it was an 86.5 average fastball velocity. 2020 was 87.7. This is not a guy who appears to have good stuff. I doubt he ever finds success at the major league level. So a pitcher that I do want to pick on to some extent. And by the way, right now in the top stacks tool, we don't have Smeltzer listed as a starting pitcher. We have Griffin Jacks, who's also not particularly good. So it's really hard to know what to make of any kind of projections here or ownership. And then once again, we don't know officially who the starting pitcher is for the Twins. Right now, it's just kind of estimated starters. But assuming
I will point out in Smeltzer's favor, like if you're somebody that does need a 4K pitcher, the reason he went 2 innings in his last start was because he got absolutely lit up, which getting lit up to give up 6 earned runs in 2 innings in your most recent AAA start doesn't inspire confidence, but he is at least stretched out. He went 5 innings to start before that. He went 5 innings in each of the 3 previous starts. So he is at least stretched out to where, like, if he's pitching well, I assume he gives you 4 or 5 innings here.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a good point as well. Cause like I said, the other minor league starts did go 4 or 5, but only 2 in the last start. So who knows, maybe they'll even piggyback him with another starter. It's something I think we probably need a little more information on. So like the video, subscribe to the YouTube channel and check out MLB Live before lock later in the day. Cause those guys will have a better idea of what we're actually going to be getting out of Smeltzer or whoever else ends up starting for the Twins today. Any takes on stacking the Guardians in this spot? Once again, it's kind of hard without knowing for sure who's starting for Minnesota.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we have a pretty good idea that whoever is starting is not very good, whether it's Jackson or Smeltzer. Yeah, I mean, they're getting some ownership. They're at 8%. They have about an 8% chance of being the top stack right now. Looks fine to me. Like, you're not getting the added, you know, you're not getting any negative correlation because nobody's going to roster whoever's pitching for Minnesota. But it is still, you know, just a pretty good spot to get to, I think. Jose Ramirez individually certainly looks very good. So, yeah, like, and Franmil Reyes at 3,300 would look pretty good as well as individual plays. But as far as the stack goes, they just kind of seem neutral to me. Like, I'm sure I'll have some, but I don't think that they're the team that I start jamming in everywhere either.
All right, let's hit on the next game. Seattle Mariners against the New York Mets. And two pitchers that I think we have to consider that are pretty good are on the mound. Chris Bassitt for the Mets, George Kirby for the Mariners. Have you seen any of the highlights of George Kirby throwing a baseball?
No, I don't think so.
So we're entering a generation of starting pitching prospects that come up where anybody who's a relatively highly ranked pitching prospect, every single one of them, it seems like, throws 100 miles per hour and has breaking balls that move like 2 feet. And George Kirby is no different. I'm watching his first start and some of the highlights of, like, Pitching Ninja, Rob Friedman. He was posting them all over Twitter. Everything George Kirby throws is ridiculous. He's throwing like a moving fastball. It's going like 100 miles per hour. Then he's got crazy off-speed pitches that move a ton. So far, the results this year, 33.3% K rate, 2.86 expected ERA, 0.67 whip. He's a young pitcher. There's going to be ups and downs. I'm sure there's going to be starts where he struggles with his command a little bit. But just based on what we've seen out of him so far, I think he's a pitcher that I want to get behind. I understand the matchup is really difficult against the Mets. And he's $8,500 over on FanDuel. On DraftKings, he's $7,800. He's not all that popular on either site either. Less than 1% ownership on FanDuel, sub 10% ownership on DraftKings. I'm just going to bet on the prospect acumen here and the stuff that I've seen with my own eyes and some of the highlights. I want to roster George Kirby here as long as he doesn't remain popular. I know the Mets have a really potent offense. I just don't care, though. The pitchers aren't that great. He's a little bit underpriced. Is he somebody you could get behind?
Yeah, the ownership being the big thing as well. I think that there's a lot of volatility with somebody like this because the stuff is clearly there. Like you said, he's averaging 96 miles an hour on his fastball. Even if you go back and look at his minor league numbers, he didn't pitch above Double A. So he made six starts at Double A last year, nine starts in High A, then six at Double A. This year he made five starts at Double A and then came straight to the majors and has made one start. So he really doesn't have any track record of pitching in the, you know, upper levels of baseball. But the thing that really stands out to me, normally when you get a young pitching prospect that has really good stuff and throws hard and strikes out a lot of guys, they struggle with walks, and he did not at all in the minors. Walked like 5.5% of hitters at Double A this year, 6.5% last year. You know, typically that rate will come up in the majors and strikeouts come down a little bit in the majors just because guys have better plate discipline. But normally you expect it to be like, oh, well, this guy strikes everybody out, but he also walks a lot. The control seems to be good for Kirby. The stuff is good. The price tag is good. And the ownership's not there. So I'm certainly willing to take a chance that, yeah, like, it's the guy's second major league start. It's the guy's second start above Double A, and he's facing one of the best offenses in baseball to this point. He can certainly get lit up, but the strikeout stuff is there. He threw 85 pitches last start. There's not a lot of high upside pitching on this slate. I am more than happy to get to Kirby at 9%.
Yeah, and then the minor league numbers, there also aren't that many minor league numbers. He threw 23 innings in 2019. In 2021, he threw 27 innings. Then this year so far in the minor leagues, he had thrown 24 innings. But one thing we have seen about him is the limited amount of data we do have on him as a professional pitcher. He's dominated everywhere he's went. Yeah. 2019, 2.35 ERA. 2021, 2.38. This year in the minor leagues, 1.82. And then his first start in the majors this year, he pitches six innings and they're six scoreless innings. So everything we've ever seen out of him is really strong results. I'm willing to bet on that kind of talent. On the other side, when it comes to the Mets, how are you going to approach them? Because like we said, he does appear to be a very talented pitcher, but there could be some question marks because the sample size is so small.
Yeah, the Mets are kind of a tough one for me because they're a good offense. They're going up against a pitcher that, you know, doesn't have any track record, but there's no reason to think this guy isn't good. You know, like you said, dominated every level he's been at, was great in his first major league start. The stuff checks out. There's no reason to look at him and say, like, oh yeah, well, I think this guy's really going to drop off. He's one of the best prospects in baseball for a reason. And my expectation is that he lives up to it. So I'm not really excited to get to the Mets, especially because Kirby's not getting much ownership. If this were a situation where, you know, you were getting 30% ownership on a guy making a second major league start against one of the best offenses in baseball, you could make a pretty strong case for like, okay, well, it's still baseball. I'll go ahead and take the really high upside offense. And I'm never upset about getting to the Mets at low ownership because of how much power they have. But on this particular slate where you have Coors Field, where you have the Yankees in a good spot, where you have Houston in a good spot, where you have, you know, several other teams that are in solid spots, it's just tough for me to really want to go out of my way to target somebody that I think is likely to be very, very good.
And then on the other side, we're going to have Chris Bassitt starting for the Mets. And the Mets rotation, once they finally get DeGrom back, it is unfair how good this is because they have Chris Bassitt, who continues to improve and has been really good this year. But then they also have Tyler McGill, who's developed into a really high-end starting pitcher, kind of out of nowhere because he was never a highly regarded prospect. And then, of course, the Mets are going to have Max Scherzer and Jacob DeGrom also. So this rotation is so deep and it's so good. So far, Bassitt this year, his velocity is down a good amount, which is a little bit of a concern, but it hasn't impacted the results at all. 2.45 ERA, 2.97 expected ERA. The strikeout rate is a career high, 26.2%. If he was seeing this kind of velocity decrease and the strikeout rate was down, I'd be a little bit more concerned. I haven't bought in on Chris Bassitt in the past, but I do at this point. And like I said, the velocity, it is down to 92.6 this year versus 93.5 last year. But the results are there, so I can't really be too concerned. The only question mark that I have with Chris Bassitt for today is how often do I want to roster him as the most expensive starting pitcher on the slate when he's 10,300 over on DraftKings, 10,100 on FanDuel, and he's expected to be fairly popular. So the only concerns I have about Bassitt is not about him individually as a pitcher. It's the price tag. It's the ownership. But how are you viewing Bassitt?
Yeah, and the matchup's not great either. 111 WRC plus, 21.7% strikeout percentage for Seattle this year. But yeah, I think Bassitt is probably the best pitcher on the slate in terms of talent at this point, considering the questions that we have with Shane Bieber. I guess talent's wording it weird because like Kirby's probably more talented than Bassitt. But I think you get the point. Like Bassitt is, I think, the best overall pitcher at this point that's pitching on today's slate. But it is a tough matchup. He is getting ownership. And I kind of mentioned it before, like I like a lot of offenses today that are getting ownership, whether it's Coors Field, whether it's the Yankees, whether it's Houston. So I do think that the way I'm looking at the slate right now, the way ownership looks, I'm likely to kind of just like say, okay, hopefully none of these popular pitchers absolutely beat me if I don't have them. Perfect world, they kind of struggle, score like 12 fantasy points, and I can just get more fantasy points from somebody like Kirby or Glenn Otto or whoever, you know, you're going to for lower ownership. So that's kind of how I see this slate right now and what I think I'll probably end up doing in a lot of my lineups. But that said, like getting to Bassitt here is obviously good. He's got a 26% strikeout percentage. The plate discipline stuff checks out. His called strike plus swinging strike percentage is 3 points higher than last year. Swinging strike percentage is up a point. Chase rate is up a point. There's nothing that I see with Bassitt that makes me not like him other than he's relatively expensive. He's getting ownership and he does have a difficult matchup.
Yeah. And once again, the pitching options, not all that great on this slate as a whole. So I understand why Chris Bassitt is chalk is the most expensive pitcher on the slate. Next spot to talk about, we have another really popular starting pitcher, Arizona Diamondbacks at home against the Chicago Cubs. Zach Gallen, who's been excellent this year. Historically, he's kind of always been undervalued by some of the betting information. Like it's pretty often that the Arizona Diamondbacks will be underdogs or teams going up against Zach Gallen will have pretty high implied run totals. I mean, I think it was two or three starts ago, Zach Gallen pitched against the Marlins. And Diamondbacks were pretty significant underdogs in that spot. But Zach Gallen this year, 24.1% K rate, 1.82 expected ERA, 0.71 whip. If I'm paying up for any starting pitcher on this slate, if you're telling me I have to just bet my life on one starter to come through for me today, I would feel best about Zach Gallen at home against the Cubs. So if you need one guy for cash games you feel is safest, I would recommend Zach Gallen. Where do you stand on him at home against Chicago?
Yeah, that's where I'm at too. I think the tiebreaker for me is just the matchup. You know, when you talk about basically, you know, you're comparing Bassitt, Bieber, and Gallen. Bassett's got the matchup against Seattle, who's been a top 10 offense this year, doesn't strike out a ton. Bieber has the question marks and also facing a Minnesota team that's been a well above average offense. And then you have the Cubs who have a 95 WRC plus, a 24% strikeout percentage. They're not expected to be a great offense this year. So it's not like you're looking at them and expecting them to rebound anytime soon. And then Gallen's just been solid. Like you said, about a 24% strikeout percentage. He's not walking guys this year, which is a big deal for him. 3.7% walk percentage. I assume that comes up a little bit going forward, but if he's able to get the walks under control, that's going to really, really bode well for him going forward. 3.66 xFIP. Everything looks good. He's a little bit less expensive than Bassett. He's also the most popular pitcher on the slate, and everything that we've said about Bassett and Bieber in terms of ownership certainly still applies here, where, you know, I don't, if nearly half the field's going to roster $9,800 Zach Gallen, I don't hate the idea of just saying like, okay, cool, hopefully he scores 15 points and I can beat him for less somewhere else. But he is my favorite payoff option as well.
And then just because of the ownership on, and there would be no other reason other than the ownership on Gallen, does this make you want to make any kind of contrarian or leverage stacks with the Cubs?
Not really. I think Gallen is really good, and the Cubs offense is really not good. So, you can always make a case for stacking against the 40% owned pitcher. It's baseball and shit happens. But on this slate, there's enough other offenses I like that I doubt I end up taking that approach.
Yeah, and we have a good point also that's coming in through Twitch, actually, from Ganja Gamer's channel, because we do have the Twitch comments get put into YouTube now, where he said Suzuki's been hurt and there's a good chance he sits, which, yeah, that's also another good point, is that say Suzuki's been the Cubs' best hitter and he's injured right now. He's dealing with an ankle injury. So if he remains out, that's another reason to like Zach Gallen and be a little bit lower on the Cubs' offense. On the other side of this game, we have Kyle Hendricks pitching for the Cubs. And for the longest time, Kyle Hendricks is a really good real life pitcher that never delivered fantasy results because of the low strikeout rate. Well, now we have a pitcher who still never delivers fantasy results, but also is bad in real life, because Kyle Hendricks, he's over the age of 30. The velocity's never really been significant, but I think any loss in arm talent for somebody with such fringe stuff like Kyle Hendricks could really be a death sentence. And that could be what we're starting to look at. Hendricks wasn't all that great last year. This year, 18.4% K rate, 4.66 expected ERA. I know the Diamondbacks offense isn't any good, but I have some interest in them against Kyle Hendricks, just because I don't think that he's really a big league caliber pitcher at this point. But how do you view the matchup between Hendricks and the D-backs offense?
Yeah, I think we're starting to see Kyle Hendricks enter like the early stages of the Dallas Keuchel fall off, where you just see these pitchers that don't have really good stuff. Like Kyle Hendricks has a fantastic changeup, but you know, they don't throw hard. They don't have the same margin of error that pitchers that throw 100 miles an hour do. And they really rely on command and changing speeds and all of that. Those guys typically just fall off of a cliff once they start to get a little bit older. And I think you're starting to see Hendricks kind of just teeter over the edge, where he's not able to just go out there and have perfect command every game and frustrate. I mean, I've stacked against this guy for years and just lost so much money doing it. Finally, I think we're getting to the point where I can maybe make some money on it. So Arizona's actually been a team that I've played a decent amount this year. And it's weird because like they're not a very good offense, but they do have some good hitters individually that are normally either cheap or play useful positions. Dalton Varsho in particular, with catcher and outfield eligibility. He's gotten expensive, but he's also good. Since the start of last year, 234 expected ISO against righties, 355 expected WOBA for Varsho. So I like him. He kind of moves me towards Arizona quite a bit. And then you just get, you know, some cheaper bats going down the order, where you have, you know, Pavin Smith, David Peralta, Josh Rojas, Kettle Marte, we know has some power and speed. So it's not the best overall offense, but it is a good spot against Hendricks. I do like getting to them. We have them right now in the top stacks tool. Ownership about where it should be, 4% chance of being a top two stack, 4% ownership projection, but we do have them with the fourth highest top value percentage. And that's something that it's difficult to talk about on shows, like the value. But when you build lineups, that does obviously play a role. And if you have a team that has a really high value rating and the ownership is actually not projected to be a lot higher than the top stack percentage, normally that's a team that I get to a lot, because it's telling me that I can build, you know, I can fit good one-offs around them. I can fit good secondary stacks with them. I can fit good pitchers, and they're not overly popular. Normally when you get a high value percentage on a team, you see the ownership percentage move up ahead of the top stack percentage. And then you're kind of like, okay, well, you know, they're good value, but they're also really popular. That's not really the case here with Arizona.
Yeah, and if you guys want access to tools like the Top Stacks tool, the Top Pitchers tool, you could get access to all the Osmo Plus tools we have for nearly every single DFS sport out there with an Osmo Plus weekly pass. And once again, that'll get you access to like the Top Stacks tool, the Top Pitchers tool, but then it also covers other sports, NBA, MMA, that's going to be later today, NHL, tennis, USFL. We've got pretty much everything covered over at Osmo.com. Stop guessing, start winning. Join Osmo Plus today. Time to talk about the most important game on the slate for a lot of people, and that is the Kansas City Royals against the Colorado Rockies. And this is going to be another one of those slates, Adam, where I think you and I are going to be on the same page, at least in how we're breaking it down for now, which is, without a doubt, this is a really good spot for both these offenses. Germán Márquez has really struggled this year, 17.7% K rate, 5.1 expected ERA. Starting for the Royals, Carlos Hernandez has a terrible makeup for pitching in Coors Field. Like, he's bad no matter where he pitches, but now you're sending somebody to Coors Field at 9.3% K rate. So it makes sense that these teams have two of the highest implied run totals on the slate, but they're also super popular. The Rockies, they're projected for 16.3% ownership as a team. The Royals against Germán Márquez projected for 18.6% ownership. If anybody wants to roster these teams, I get it. They're the two most popular offenses on the slate. A lot of people are going to do it, but my inclination is wanting to be underweight to these teams. If I had to pick one of them, I prefer Colorado against Carlos Hernandez as opposed to the Royals against Germán Márquez. But once again, I think there's a little bit too much ownership here. But how are you going to approach these offenses when they are expected to be so popular?
Yeah, I mean, if I can get teams where, you know, I have low on pitching or I have a low on secondary stack or whatever, obviously I'm going to be perfectly happy getting to these teams. Neither one's that expensive. Kansas City in particular has the, I think, highest. Highest top value percentage in the top stacks tool. So that's something that, you know, is also driving up their ownership. But one issue too is sometimes you'll get teams where if you're just looking at the top stacks tool, it can be kind of misleading because, you know, one or two players are really popular. And then the, you know, if you round out a stack, you still have some contrarian plays in there. If you just look at the ownership projections for every hitter on Kansas City and Colorado, the only guys sub 10% on DraftKings are Jose Iglesias at 4,500 and Hunter Dozier at 4,500. That's it. Other than that, it's the pitchers, those two. Everybody else is at least 10% owned. On the plus side, the only guys north of 20% are Perez, Witt, and Krohn, who I think all three are clearly top plays. So, you know, it's a lot of ownership, but it's not like you're getting to the wildly crazy, like, oh, this, I'm playing some 35% on hitter point. But mostly it's just that I like enough other stacks on this slate that are, you know, half the ownership or even less. So that's kind of the thing for me is, sure, like if I happen to end up getting a lot of Colorado and Kansas City, I'll be really happy because with the way I build my lineups, it means that I found some way to be, have contrarian lineups while still getting to them. My assumption is that I'm going to just end up playing Houston, the Yankees, you know, these other teams that are getting less ownership and just hoping that, you know, you get a mild, you know, an underwhelming Coors game.
Are you surprised at all that the Royals are projected to be more popular than the Rockies? Just because, I mean, Germán Márquez, I understand the results haven't been good this year, but he's been a quality pitcher in the past and has found success at Coors Field. Whereas on the other side, like Carlos Hernandez sucks everywhere. If you put Carlos Hernandez in a pitcher's park, it's going poorly. And once again, it's kind of just splitting hairs because the Rockies are the second most popular offense on the slate. But just considering how bad Carlos Hernandez is and that the Rockies have an implied run total about a run higher than the Royals, I kind of am surprised that we're not seeing even more ownership going to the Rockies. Is that something that stands out to you at all?
I mean, it makes sense. There's four guys on Kansas City in their projected lineup that are sub 3K on DraftKings, including their expected cleanup hitter in Carlos Santana. So it's just how cheap they are. Like the cheapest guy on Colorado is Sam Hilliard at 3,100. Brendan Rodgers is 3,500. Then nobody else on Colorado is less than 4,500. Kansas City has five guys below 4,500, including Bobby Witt Jr. And again, their cleanup hitter, who's 2,400. So it's just a value thing, I think, where, I'm sure people would rather take hitters against Carlos Hernandez than Germán Márquez, but you can basically just stack Kansas City and do whatever the hell you want with the rest of your team.
So I think it's pretty impossible to consider Carlos Hernandez in this spot, even considering all the ownership going against him. But do you have any interest in Germán Márquez as a contrarian pitching option? It would be more of a DraftKings question than FanDuel just because he's 6,600. So that would be a viable SP2 salary. And he's not picking up much ownership. And once again, like I said before, Germán Márquez, while the results aren't there this year, he's pitched serviceably at Coors Field in the past. Is there any consideration to him as a SP2 leverage option?
Yeah, I don't hate it. The strikeout numbers aren't there this year, like you said, 17.7% strikeout percentage. Still a 3.67 xFIP, though. And Kansas City has been the worst offense in baseball, 76 WRC+, only a 19.6% strikeout percentage, which is something that, you know, one, it's frustrating to take pitchers against, and two, it does bode well for Coors Field when you have a team that puts the ball in play and has a lot of speed. You know, everybody everybody thinks about Coors Field in terms of home runs and power, but a lot of it is just that balls that have no business falling in for hits fall in because the outfield is massive. Singles turn into doubles when you have speed. Fast guys get more triples. So Kansas City's kind of built for Coors Field offensively, but they still have a bunch of pretty bad hitters in their lineup. And Marquez, I think, is still a decent pitcher, even though the strikeout numbers have been down this year. And then the big thing is that he's really cheap. He's not getting much ownership. And if he does pitch well, you just took 20% of the field out of contention. So certainly a difficult name to click on. I'm not going to be like upset if I don't get a lot, but just from a strategy standpoint, I do think Marquez makes sense.
All right. The next game to talk about, the Los Angeles Angels at the Oakland A's. And for my money, the worst starting pitcher going today is Adam Oller of Oakland, who so far this year has a 15.4% strikeout rate, a 10.11 expected ERA. So Adam Oller is another one of these guys who unheralded pitching prospect, and by unheralded, like just totally unranked prospect overall. So he spent his career toiling in the minor leagues with a bunch of different organizations. And this is never a good sign for a starting pitcher. If you're 27 years old, you've never made it up to the big leagues and you've bounced around multiple organizations. He was in the Pittsburgh's minor league system, the Giants minor league system, the Mets minor league system, the A's minor league system. He finally gets called up at age 27. He's made three starts this year, 11.17 ERA. Like I said, the really high expected ERA also. It just doesn't seem like there's any promise to this guy at the big league level. He's probably a career minor leaguer. I'm a little surprised he's even made it up to the big leagues at this point because his double A numbers weren't great, weren't all that great last year. I guess he did okay in triple A. But Adam Oller, this seems like a pitcher to pick on. And the Angels have a loaded offense in terms of power, top to bottom. There is a lot of landmines in the Angels offense that pitchers have to go up against. And we're starting to see some of the younger hitters perform a little bit better this year. And that doesn't even take into account that Taylor Ward has been ridiculous this season. So I like getting to the Angels in this spot. They're only projected for 2.6% ownership. I think this is my favorite contrarian offense to get to on the slate. Are you going to be stacking them against Adam Oller?
Yeah. So one thing in Adam Oller's defense is he did spend 4 years in the Pirates system. And if you're a pitcher in the Pirates system, you can kind of just write those off because the Pirates don't know what the hell they're doing. Jokes aside, there's no reason to think this guy's going to be good. Like you said, when guys bounce around and they don't make it to the majors until they're 27, 28, yeah, sometimes they happen to stick and they figure it out at least for a little bit. But more often than not, they're not going to be good. And then also, you have to keep in mind what team he's on. It's not like this is a contending team that's like, oh no, we think we found something in this guy, we're bringing him up. He's on one of the worst teams in baseball. They are pitching him because they just need somebody to go out there and throw a baseball for a little bit. So there's no reason to think this guy's going to be good. And like you said, the Angels have tons of power in their lineup. I really like getting to them too, because they're expensive, at least at the top with the guys that you would want. In the top stacks tool, we have them with one of the lowest top value percentages, and that's why they're not getting much ownership here. But there's a couple of ways you can counteract that on this slate. For one, Ward, Trout, Otani are expensive. Rendon's 4,100, but Jared Walsh is only 3,800. Brandon Marsh is only 3,400. Those guys are cheap enough where, you know, they offset some of that cost. But then we've also talked about it where if you just don't, you know, if you don't use as much of those expensive pitchers that look good but not great, and you are willing to take chances on guys like Kirby or Otto or Marquez or whatever guy in that price range that you like, it's going to make it really easy to afford the Angels at low ownership. This team has a ton of power, like you said. Two of the best hitters in baseball in Otani and Trout. Taylor Ward's been excellent this year. Rendon has power. Marsh and Walsh, you know, both have power. So the Angels have actually been the best team in baseball by WRC Plus so far this year. 178 ISO is, I believe, second best. Second best in baseball behind only the Brewers. 2% aggregate ownership going to the Angels. I really like getting to the Angels.
Yeah, same. I'm surprised that given the numbers of Adam Oller, that the Angels are not more popular, but that's where we're at. This is one of the least owned offenses on the entire slate. On the other side, Michael Lorenzen is the expected starting pitcher for the Angels. Once again, not confirmed, but he is who is expected to start. His numbers this year, they're pretty mediocre, 18.3% K rate, 3.82 expected ERA. He does have a really favorable matchup against the Oakland A's, who are also at home. It's in Oakland, which is a pitcher's park. Ultimately, though, I don't think I'm going to really want to get exposure to Michael Lorenzen. He doesn't do that much for me. I don't want to stack the Oakland A's against him either because it's a pitcher's park and the A's offense isn't any good. So this seems like a spot that I'm not really interested in either side. Do you see it differently?
I'm interested in Lorenzen. We do have him projected for 29% ownership right now, which isn't ideal, but he's only 8K. The strikeout stuff overall this year hasn't been there, but it's kind of been like start by start. He's got two starts where he struck out seven, one against Miami, one against Washington. Then he struck out 2-3-2 against Houston, Cleveland, and the White Sox. So you're talking about, you know, two good offenses in Houston and the White Sox. Well, I guess really three at this point, given what Cleveland's done this year. But at the very least, an offense in Cleveland doesn't strike out. And you've just seen Lorenzen, from a strikeout standpoint, you know, carve up Miami and Washington, two teams where, you know, he'd be a little bit more likely to have success. He still struggled against Washington in terms of runs allowed. But at 8K in a good pitcher's park, I do like this spot for Lorenzen. The ownership's just the concern for me. Like, if you're going to get 28% ownership going to Lorenzen at 8K, and you're going to get 9% going to George Kirby at 7,800, I understand that Oakland is a much, much better matchup than the Mets, but why wouldn't I just take Kirby?
Yeah,
and,
I mean, that's
at least in, and not saying in every lineup, but like that ownership, Michael Lorenzen, I don't care who he's facing, should not be three times as popular as George Kirby.
I mean, I would argue there's probably never a slate where Michael Lorenzen should be really popular, unless it's a two-game slate where there's limited options. But I mean, it's a nine-game slate. We've got 18 pitchers to choose from. It's hard for me to think that Michael Lorenzen belongs in a third of those lineups. But even with that said, I don't think I'm going to be looking to Oakland to get leverage in this spot because this offense is terrible.
Yeah, agreed. Although I have actually played Oakland more than I would like this year. But I'm with you. I think that I just have so many other offenses I like today.
Yeah, there's a lot of high-end offenses, and it's not a lot of ownership, but we do have 2% ownership going to Oakland, and they're projected with a 2% top stack odd. So it seems more or less appropriate. There's some of the other spots where Oakland's looked better. It's because they've been like a 3% top stack team with sub 1% ownership. There actually is some ownership going to them, even if it's a minimal amount. Let's hit on the final game of the slate now. The Philadelphia Phillies on the road against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Julio Urias on the mound for the Dodgers. Ranger Suarez for Philly. And first, I want to start by asking about Urias because he's a really, really high-end pitching prospect, and he's been really successful at the big league level. But we're not seeing that many strikeouts this year, and the Dodgers are also really cautious with his pitch counts. So there's been a lot of games where we'll see like, hey, Urias is pitching really well. Maybe he's got like 6 shutout innings, 3 strikeouts, and he just won't come out for the 7th inning. So another guy I think is fairly safe against the Phillies, although the Phillies have a really good offense. But I'm not sure that the ceiling is really there for Urias compared to some of the other pitchers on the slate. Like, even if I'm down on Bieber a little bit, I think he's more upside than Urias. Same goes for guys like Kirby, Javier, Bassett, Zach Gallen. So Urias, to me, I think ultimately is somebody who ends up in like 10 to 15% of my lineups, but I'm not going to be prioritizing him.
Yeah, I mean, the counter is, because I agree with everything you said, the counter is that, you know, Zach Gallen's getting 4 times the ownership. Bieber's getting 3 times the ownership. And I think that while the top end ceiling is probably lower for Urias, because I just don't think they're going to let him go 8 or 9 innings like these other guys potentially could if they're, you know, pitching really well. Within reason, I think that he has the same sort of upside, you know, even if it's not the same very, you know, 99th percentile outcome. And so I don't really think that the ownership difference should be that big, but it is also a difficult matchup against the Phillies. And then one other kind of question I have is I'm not sure if they're really limiting his pitch count or if they're just pulling him after 6 innings. Like, in the sense where, like, last start, he went 6 innings, he threw 82 pitches. The start before that, he went 6 innings, he threw 65 pitches. Start before that, 6 innings, 81 pitches. I'm not sure that, like, in the 6th inning, let's say he were at, you know, getting to 90, 91, 92 pitches, I don't know that they just come yank him in the middle of the inning, but it does seem very apparent that he's not going out there for the 7th inning. At least, you know, that's what we've seen so far. So that's what kind of caps the very top end ceiling. But I am still kind of interested just because of the gap in ownership between Bassett, Gallen, Bieber, and then the fall off down to Urias.
And then on the other side of the game, Ranger Suarez is going to be starting for the Phillies. The Dodgers have a really high implied run total at 5 runs, one of the higher marks on the slate, which, I mean, it shouldn't come all that surprising. It is the Dodgers offense. It is top to bottom the best offense in baseball. They've just loaded from the 1 spot in the lineup to the 9 spot. Ranger Suarez was really good last year and hasn't been nearly as good this year. Not that we would have expected, because last year he had a 1.36 ERA and a 2.6 expected ERA. Those were never numbers that we could count on. This year, 3.68 ERA, 4.48 expected ERA. Also a really big dip in strikeout rate, because last year he had a 25.6% K rate. This year it's down to 16.7. Ultimately, I just don't know who Ranger Suarez is as a pitcher because the numbers are so all over the place. I guess I just kind of lean on the Zips and Steamer projections who are like, this is a low 4 ERA guy with a low strikeout rate. But where do you stand on Ranger Suarez and what's a really difficult matchup?
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of him either, because last year I didn't think he should be very good, and he just kept being really, really good. And I was like, all right, whatever, I guess that's what this guy is. And then this year, like, he probably shouldn't be as bad as he has been. But this is more in line with, like, kind of what I thought we were getting when he moved from closer to starter last year, with someone who should get worse as a starter. Didn't happen last year, but so far this year, it's really stood out, in particular against right-handed hitters, you know, as you would expect. Last year, he has a good changeup and had a lot of success with it last year. He struck out 23% of righties, held them to a 0.084 expected ISO. This year so far, only a 16% strikeout percentage against righties. He's allowed a 181 actual ISO, but his expected ISO is even higher at 229. So he's really just had no success against opposite-handed hitters this year. And you certainly have plenty of right-handed power with Betts, Turner, Smith, other Turner. Chris Taylor has some power. And then the lefties in this lineup hit left-handed pitching well anyway. And of course, if you get Suarez out early, then you know you're getting some bullpen matchups regardless. So I do like the Dodgers. They are projected to be a bit under-owned here. Even if you assume that Suarez is just like a solid pitcher, which I think is fair, probably not as bad as he has been this year, probably not as good as he was last year. If anytime you give me the Dodgers at, you know, what, 4% ownership against probably an average pitcher, I'm more than happy to get there.
Yeah, and once again, the Dodgers, there are teams, and people have heard me say this multiple times now, there are these offenses, the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Blue Jays offense. If you get them at modest ownership, I'm interested. I don't even care where the pitcher is. I don't care what ballpark there is. These offenses are so good. If they have modest ownership, I'm going to be interested. And this is a spot for the Dodgers against Ranger Suarez. We don't know if Suarez is good. We don't know if he's bad. All right, well, the Dodgers, we know they're good. If there's a chance Ranger Suarez is bad, I'm gonna want to get to the Dodgers here. On the other side, any interest in the Phillies offense going up against Urias?
Not too much. I mean, you can kind of make the same case for the Phillies, where they do have a lot of power. They are a team that typically I'm willing to get to when they're low owned. The thing that makes this slate a little bit different, I mean, one, I do have a lot of respect for Urias as a pitcher, but it's just there's so many teams that are relatively low owned because of Coors. If this were a slate, you know, again, like if Coors didn't exist, and so you were getting, you know, twice as much ownership on Houston as you are right now, and twice as much on the Yankees, and the Dodgers are more popular and all of that, then you could talk me into saying like, okay, cool, I'll take some shots at really high upside Phillies bats. But when you have, you know, Houston and the Yankees still getting some ownership, but then you have the Dodgers at 4%, you have the Angels at 2%, you have Minnesota at 3%, if you wanted to take a stack against a good pitcher. At least Bieber is getting 30% ownership, whereas Arias is getting 10. So it's a little bit more powerful to go to the Twins. There's just so many offenses I like at low ownership that it makes it kind of difficult for me to get to Philly. And right now we're actually projecting them for a lot of ownership as well, because they're pretty inexpensive. I'm looking now to see kind of what the individual ownership looks like, because my assumption is that you're just going to see, yeah, I mean, you have 16% ownership going to a $2,700 Hoskins, 12% going to a $2,100 Stott, 12% going to a $3,400 Real Muto, and 11% to a $3,300 Castellanos. Those are insanely cheap prices. So that's good. Like, those guys should never be that cheap. I don't care who they're facing. But that said, if the ownership's going to be there, I can just not stack against Urias and be fine.
And that is going to do it for us. That wraps up the 9-game slate. Do us a favor, guys. Like the video, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and check out the other content we have today. We have MLB Live Before Lock. We have MMA Live Before Lock. I know there's no NBA, but it's okay because we've got other sports covered here. So check all that out. Other than that, hope you guys come back for the shows later in the day, and good luck.